Kim by Rudyard Kipling. Chapter 1, Part 1. O ye who tread the narrow way by Tophet flare to judgment day, be gentle when the heathen pray to Buddha at Kamakura. Buddha at Kamakura. He sat in defiance of municipal orders astride the gun Zamzamar on her brick platform opposite the old Ajib Gir, the Wonder House, as the natives call the Lahore Museum. Who hold Zamzamar, that fire-breathing dragon, hold the Punjab? For the great green bronze piece is always the first of the conqueror's loot. There was some justification for Kim. He had kicked Lala Dinanath's boy off the trunnions since the English held the Punjab, and Kim was English. Though he was burned black as any native, though he spoke the vernacular by preference and his mother tongue in a clipped, uncertain sing-song, though he consorted on terms of perfect equality with the small boys of the bazaar, Kim was white. A poor white of the very poorest. The half-caste woman who looked after him—she smoked opium and pretended to keep a second-hand furniture shop by the square where the cheap cabs wait—told the missionaries that she was Kim's mother's sister. But his mother had been a nursemaid in a colonel's family, and had married Kimball O'Hara, a young colour sergeant of the Mavericks, an Irish regiment. He afterwards took a post in the Sindh, Punjab and Delhi Railway, and his regiment went home without him. The wife died of cholera in Ferozepur, and O'Hara fell to drink and loafing up and down the line with a keen-eyed three-year-old baby. Societies and chaplains, anxious for the child, tried to catch him, but O'Hara drifted away till he came across the woman who took opium and learned the taste from her, and died as poor whites do in India. His estate at death consisted of three papers. One he called his Ne Varatur, because those words were written below his signature thereon, and another his clearance certificate. The third was Kim's birth certificate. Those things, he used to say in his glorious opium hours, would yet make little Kimball a man. On no account was Kim to part with them, for they belonged to a great piece of magic, such magic as men practised over yonder behind the museum, in the big blue-and-white Jadugair, the magic house, as we name the Masonic Lodge. It would, he said, all come right some day, and Kim's horn would be exalted between pillars, monstrous pillars, of beauty and strength. The colonel himself, riding on a horse at the head of the finest regiment in the world, would attend to Kim, little Kim that should have been better off than his father. 900 first-class devils, whose god was a red bull on a green field, would attend to Kim, if they had not forgotten O'Hara, poor O'Hara, that was gang foreman on the Ferozepur line. Then he would weep bitterly in the broken rush chair on the veranda. So it came about after his death that the woman sewed parchment, paper, and birth certificate into a leather amulet case, which she strung around Kim's neck. And some day, she said, confusedly remembering O'Hara's prophecies, there will come for you a great red bull on a green field, and the colonel riding on his tall horse, yes, and dropping into English, 900 devils. Ah, said Kim, I shall remember. A red bull and a colonel on a horse will come, but first, my father said, will come the two men making ready the ground for these matters. That is how my father said they always did, and it is always so when men work magic. If the woman had sent Kim up to the local Jadugur with these papers, he would, of course, have been taken over by the provincial lodge and sent to the Masonic orphanage in the hills. But what she had heard of magic she distrusted.